Charles, you've written a great deal about how we might rethink our economic system and specifically how we use money. What do you see as the fundamental problem with how money shapes our lives?
Yeah, I think that the fundamental problem goes a lot deeper than is ordinarily recognized in the political discourse. I think it goes down to the way that money is created and circulates in our system. Basically, to make a very long story short, it's created as interest-bearing debt, which means that there's always more debt than there is money, so that scarcity, anxiety, and competition and the need for endless growth are kind of built into the money system almost on a design level.
Hmm. So how does this affect us in our daily lives?
Well, the phrase, there's always more debt than there is money, might resonate with a lot of people, or the experience of there never being enough money. And you look around, you know, and you can ask what seem like naive questions. Like, if we're becoming more and more productive and we have more and more technology, then why does it seem that we have to work harder and harder? Or why, like on the governmental level, why are there all of these functions that in the 50s and the 60s we could easily afford, but now we can no longer afford them?
Give me some examples of what you mean.
Well, how about public education? You know, I mean, it was in the 60s, it was basically free. Tuition was very, very low. And now it's, you know, we can no longer afford to do that, supposedly. Or a lot of municipal services all around the country, you know, libraries, parks, even police forces are being scaled back. And is that because our machines no longer work? Our labor-saving devices no longer work? Is that because we've lost our productivity, our skills? You know, no. It's all because of the lack of money, which is not based on anything physical. I mean, in theory, we could create as much as we want of it. It's just symbols.
So what has changed since the 1950s or 60s when a lot of those government services were easy to pay for?
Well, we have, as you may have noticed, kind of this ongoing financial crisis that surfaced in 2008 and which is now still kind of simmering under the surface. Everyone knows that it hasn't gone away. But basically, and again, I'd be making a long story short here, and it's also very complicated, but basically more and more of our productivity is channeled toward meeting our debt obligations. And more money is in the hands of people or banks, you know, corporations who don't need to spend it. So it's not, and I mean, I'm not sure how deeply to get into the whole story, but I think that the crux of the matter comes with the slowdown in economic growth that began to happen in the early 1970s.
So you're saying there's a spiraling effect here. The economy started slowing down a few decades ago. That created this endemic problem of debt, which has led, I suppose, politically to the cries for more austerity, for tightening our belts and reducing services.
Yeah. So suppose that you owe debt. You owe money. Okay, and you have to make your debt payment. You have to service your debt every month. And if your income is growing, then that's not a problem. But what if your income is shrinking? Then, in order to make those payments, you're going to have to either pawn your assets, or work harder, or make do with less. Stop taking vacations. You know, maybe move to a smaller house, eat less, or whatever, so that you can devote a greater percentage of a smaller income to servicing the debts. So something equivalent happens when economic growth slows down or stops. So it's like, take for example a country like Spain or Greece or Italy, where they can't make their debt payments. So they get lent more money to temporarily pay off their existing obligations. And that more money comes with interest, maybe 5 or 7%. So if their economy grows at 5 or 7% or more, then when those new debts come due, it'll be easier for them to pay it back. But if their economy doesn't grow, then really you've just pushed the crisis into the future. And so if they're not going to pay it from economic growth, how are they going to pay it? Well, you know, they can sell off some islands, you know, privatize public services, cut pensions, and do all of those things that we call austerity. And that same dynamic, that same pressure is also happening here.
So the way you've talked about this, I mean, money is a problem here. I mean, obviously, we don't have enough of it. We're sort of always scrambling for more. Is there a healthier way of thinking about money?
Yeah, you know, I'm not one of those kind of new age guys who says that our problem, you know, is just our attitudes toward money and that money is this neutral thing. These problems are inherent in the way that we create money. And there are other ways to create money. There are other ways, for example, instead of issuing money as debt, essentially, the government could just create money out of thin air, which a lot of people think that it does. But actually, the way that it happens is that the Federal Reserve purchases securities. Traditionally, it would be bonds. Now it's all kinds of stuff. But purchases securities on the open market. And when the Fed or a central bank in another place does that, it creates that money out of thin air.
And basically just prints more dollar bills.
Exactly. Yeah. So it maybe, you know, buys $1 billion of bonds. There's $1 billion new dollars. But those bonds come with interest. So ultimately, the government is going to have to pay back more than just $1 billion. And everybody is in the same boat. You can imagine it like a game of musical chairs. You know, imagine 20 people in the room, 19 chairs, and everybody is, the music stops and everybody's, you know, pushing and shoving for a chair, because if you don't get a chair, that means that your kids don't eat. You know, that means you lose your house. There's a lot at stake here. So everyone's pushing and shoving to get a chair, and the economist looks on the scene and says, ah, there's human nature for you. Competitive, self-interested. But is that human nature, or is that just what's been brought out by the rules of the game? So the money system is very much like that. You know, everybody is, say I'm a bank, I lend everybody, all 20 people, $1 million, and they all owe me, I don't know, $2 million, say, after 10 years' time. Well, any single person, if they're smart and hardworking and creative, they can earn that $2 million or $5 million from the other people in the room and pay me back, but not everybody can do that. Mm-hmm. So in 10 years, half of the room is going to have to go bankrupt unless, and this is how the system works when it's working, unless I've lent new money into existence so that the old loans can be paid. Mm-hmm. But the new money comes with even more debt, but that's okay because when those debts come due, I'll lend even more money into existence. Well, and so one more piece of it, who am I going to lend to? I'm going to lend to you if you have a business plan. If you say, hey, Charles, you know, I'm going to cut down that forest and build a strip mall, and here's my plan to make lots of money. And I say, good plan, Steve. I'll lend you that money. But if your plan is, yeah, you know, I want $1 million to preserve the wetlands, then I'm like, sorry, I'd like to give that to you, but, you know, you're not going to be able to pay me back. So there's this systemic pressure to engage in activities that are going to create new goods and services, which means ultimately turning nature into product or turning relationships into paid services.
Hmm. Now, you've written a book called Sacred Economics, which I have to say sounds kind of like an oxymoron here, but are you talking about finding a way to make money sacred?
Yeah, you know, I asked the question, why does it seem that usually that money is the enemy of all of the beautiful things we want to do? And why is it that when you ask, you know, why are we destroying the rainforests? You know, why are we doing all these terrible things on the planet? And you ask down a couple levels of why, and it becomes somebody's making a profit from it. Like, and on a personal level too, for many, many people, the beautiful noble, generous thing that you want to do in your life, there's not a lot of money in that. And the money is in something that, you know, you don't care about or that you know on some level is destructive, but hey, man, I got to feed my family. You know, why shouldn't money be aligned with what's good and beautiful and sacred? That's the starting question. And then so I write about why. I already spoke about it a little bit just now, you know, why money has the effects that it does. And it's not just because of what I said. There's a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. And then how would it have to change in order to be aligned with the things that are becoming sacred to us as a civilization?
So how do we do that? I mean, how do we align money, you know, buying things, selling things to correspond to our values?
Yeah, I mean, on the personal level, I mean, that's one issue. You know, you can, to some extent, you know, buy whatever green products, fair trade products. You know, you can try to align your purchasing decisions with your values. But at some point, you realize that the whole system is complicit in ecocide, and that systems change is necessary too. It's not just about changing personal habits. And most of the book is about the systems level. If you want, I can go into a few.
Yes, if you could. Yeah. And if you could give some examples of how to sort of rethink, I mean, how to reorient our values so that we can think about money in a totally new way.
Yeah. Well, okay. So one of our new values, which, of course, is also a very ancient value, but it's care for the planet, care for nature. But our economic system encourages the opposite. So you can, very often, you can pollute, you can emit carbon or emit, you know, sulfur dioxide or create toxic waste, you know, create fertilizer runoff that poisons, that causes algae blooms. I mean, you can do a lot of environmentally damaging things, draw down aquifers, and you don't pay the costs. Somebody else pays the costs. Future generations pay the costs, but you get the profits. So these costs are external to the balance sheet. So one thing that we can do to realign economic interest with ecological and social interest is to internalize these costs. One way to do that would be through green taxes, through perhaps a carbon fee and dividend, so that the best ecological decision can be aligned with the best business decision. Mm-hmm. Like right now, if you're like a brilliant inventor and you invent, you know, some zero waste manufacturing process, there's just not a lot of financial incentive to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not really rewarded for that.
Yeah.
And we could change that.
Hmm. What about at a more personal level? I mean, just in terms of how we use money in our day-to-day lives, or if we're concerned about this whole notion that sort of everything becomes commodified, everything is monetized, is there a way we can construct our lives so that money is not so sort of all important, sort of always there hanging over us?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people want to reclaim some of life for money. You know, we pay for things today that a generation ago, or especially 100 years ago, people didn't pay for. For example, when I was a kid, we didn't really pay for food preparation very much. Mom cooked, and occasionally we'd go out to a restaurant. Today, something like 60 or 70% of all meals are prepared outside the home, either at restaurants or supermarket delis, you know. So this is a function, a human function that's been monetized and that a lot of people want to reclaim. There's a whole movement called reskilling that involves relearning these ways of taking care of ourselves and each other without paying somebody to do that.
Are you talking about cooking classes or something more elaborate than that?
Well, I mean, it could be, you know, learning how to fix things, learning how to build things. There's things like child care co-ops, where instead of paying a daycare center, a community gets together and takes care of children without, you know, using money. Tool libraries, you know, instead of every house having their own set of power tools. You know, like how often do you use your electric drill?
Right.
You know, like 15 minutes a year, maybe. So why not have like a, you know, a big tool shed in the middle of the neighborhood where everybody goes to? So this is you know, one way. And then, of course, there's people going back to the land, you know, and reclaiming life from money in a big way.
So, I mean, it sounds like what you're really saying is we need more of a sense of community built into daily life. Because, I mean, of course, the thing that money allows us to do is we can just go out and buy whatever stuff we want. And we can do that basically without having to interact with other people in a meaningful way. And you're saying that's the root of the problem here.
Well, it's pretty deep down, you know. A lot of people really want to have community, but they also want their financial independence. Those two things are contradictory. Financial independence means I don't need anybody. So you can try to be nice to your neighbors, you know, but underneath that interaction is the knowledge, I really don't need you, and you really don't need me. If you disappeared from the earth, it wouldn't change my life much at all, because whatever function you serve, I can pay somebody to do that. And that wasn't like that in, say, you know, a frontier village in the 18th century. You know, people really relied on each other. So in that context, so this, there's like a much deeper level here that is, I think that the economic crisis is rooted in a much deeper crisis and a much deeper transition in our basic experience of being human and our, I call it our deep mythology, that says, why are we here? What is a human being? What's important? Where do we come from? Where are we going? How does the world work? So the dominant mythology today is of the separate self. You know, it says who you are is a separate individual in among other individuals in a world that is other, an objective universe full of impersonal forces that's really indifferent to you. And so your well-being comes through controlling as much of as possible of this world outside yourself. And the more you control, then that's less for me. So more for you is less for me. So we're all in competition with each other. There's this kind of deep ontology that is fully consistent with the way that our money system works. But I think that that's changing. So in a community, it's not true that more for you is less for me. In a community, your well-being enables you to contribute more. So that's to my well-being as well.
Well, you've talked about, you've written about what you call a gift economy. What are some of the elements of that?
Yeah, a gift economy consists of the ways that people take care of each other that are not mediated by money. And it's not barter either. You know, it's not a gift. You give it without being in control of what you were going to receive.
So it's not, you know, I fix your car so you will paint my living room.
Right. But if I fix your car and I contribute to the community in other ways, then I feel secure because I know that people are watching me. I know that my generosity is witnessed. And I know from watching everybody else and watching how the community works, I know that those who do that, if they are in need, they'll be taken care of too. So it's not entirely, it's not like these altruistic gifts that are in contradistinction to self-interest.
Now, are you advocating abolishing money?
No, I'm advocating, I guess you could say I'm a degrowth advocate. I think that the monetized realm needs to shrink, but I do think that it has its proper domain.
So play this out for me. So what would be, in your ideal world, what would be the kinds of things that we would spend money on, and what other things would happen without any money involved?
Well, I think that anything that requires a global or at least a translocal coordination of labor and resources is going to have to be mediated somehow by money. You know, if like electronics, you know, computers, automobiles, anything that requires a vast division of labor across the planet is going to require money. But a lot of functions that could be local and should be local today are also translocal, especially the production of food, you know, the production of building materials, the production of entertainment to a large extent. When I go to less, quote, developed countries, I find that people sing a lot more. They play a lot more. They don't purchase songs as much or purchase play in the form of video games. You know, this is a kind of a community function. So
yeah, there's less listening to music on their smartphones.
Right. Yeah. And there's more sharing. You know, like that the tool library I talked about before, one thing that is kind of ironic is that those are bad for the economy, because instead of having every household buy their own set of power tools, now every 100 households needs one or two sets of power tools. So what about the power tool manufacturers? What about the people working for those companies? There's going to be, the more that the sharing economy and the gift economy grows, the less GDP growth there's going to be.
So what about that? I mean, what about putting some of those tool manufacturing companies out of business and, you know, times a million when you add lots of other things that could potentially be done more locally?
Yeah, I mean, this is a crisis for our system. And ultimately, what we need is a system that can flourish in the absence of growth. I was trying to explain before how our system needs growth to work. You know, there has to be, you know, your business plan that says, yes, I can lend you money because you're going to make even more money back. Our system only works in the presence of growth. So another thing I write about then is money systems that don't require growth, that allow money to circulate even when the money economy is shrinking.
So what would be some of those kinds of money systems?
Well, one of them, the one that I favor, I mean, there's a few, but the one that I favor is to levy. It's basically the same as things are now, except that there is a liquidity fee on bank reserves. And this is an idea that goes back to the early 20th century and has been tried out in a few limited cases. Basically, you could look at it as depreciating money. And I'll just give kind of the modern way to do it, which would be, so say you're, you know, Chase Manhattan Bank or somebody like that, and you have $100 billion of reserves parked at the Fed. Today, if there are no productive investment opportunities, if there's no economic growth happening, then you're better off just keeping that money parked at the Fed rather than lending it at risk and losing money. Or maybe you're going to, you know, invest it in these risk-free or highly risky, but you know they're going to get bailed out, so therefore risk-free speculative instruments and derivatives and things like that. But you're not going to lend it to the people who actually need it. But suppose now that your $100 billion was subject to a 5% negative interest rate if you park it at the Fed. Well, now you'd be willing to lend it out at zero interest, and it's somewhat of a complicated chain of reasoning, but the result is that the economy could work, money could circulate in the absence of growth. And this is something that almost wants to happen. You know, the Fed, after 2008, it lowered interest rates and lowered interest rates down to zero, but then it couldn't lower them anymore. So it had to do quantitative easing and hope, well, you know, maybe banks, if we give you enough money, maybe then you'll start lending it. But it's still really limited. Mm-hmm. And most of the money, you know, pumped up the stock market, you know, and went into speculation and stuff. But it's almost like the Fed and other central banks, and this is actually starting to happen in Europe. It's been talked about in the ECB, Sweden, Switzerland, Japan, they've kind of flirted with it. But what if you didn't have that restriction and the Fed could break the lower bound and go below zero?
So is this all kind of pie in the sky thinking? I mean, this whole idea of a degrowth economy, which runs so counter to everything you read about in mainstream economics.
Yeah. You know, like I've in doing the research, I found quite a few scholarly references and discussions of negative interest banking and stuff. But, you know, it is very, very far off the radar screen. Although getting closer, as I said, it's being broached now in Europe. But you know, so many of our intuitions about what a healthy economy is are based on the assumption that money is going to be created with, you know, interest-bearing debt. I mean, it's just woven into our intuitions. So I think it's going to take a pretty big crisis to open us to alternatives that seem radical now.
How do you apply some of these ideas to your own life? I mean, have you figured out a way, for instance, to not have money play such a dominant role in your life, or to sort of sort out the balance between work and leisure?
Well, I think that on the personal level, the most important kind of foundational piece is to understand that the economist's view of human nature is wrong. We are not here to maximize rational self-interest. We are here to contribute, to give, to contribute to something larger than ourselves. Almost anybody I've ever met who has financial security, has, you know, a high-paying job, lots of assets, and so forth, but who's doing something that doesn't really make their heart sing, they're not going to be happy. They're going to feel, I wasn't put here on earth to do this. I'm here for a purpose. I'm here for a reason, not just to survive, not just to be secure. And I think that for me, you know, really embracing that as the truth of my nature is, it's the source of all kinds of changes. I am here to give, and this is universally true.
How does that play out in a concrete way?
Well, so say you're a college student or you're going through a career change, you know, and here's the guidance counselor saying, oh, well, you're good at art, huh? Well, you can go into advertising. Here's how to monetize your gift. So the reorientation would be to say, here's my gift, and what is calling forth my gift? How can I use this to contribute to what's meaningful and important and beautiful to me? So it's a basic reorientation.
And what about for you personally? I mean, how have you, or have you, managed to somehow reduce the amount of your life that is monetized?
Well, I mean, I do a lot of my work on a gift basis. So, for example, my books are available online in their entirety. You can read them in HTML. You can download a PDF or whatever. And if you choose to pay me, you can. A lot of people, of course, buy the print book anyway. And I want to credit my publisher for being brave enough to try this. It was quite a stretch for them at the beginning. You know, basically, like, I really believe in my work. You know, I'm not doing it as the you know, most clever way I can make money. I believe in it, and I want people to have it. And I don't want to say, oh, you know, I'm only going to give this to you if you pay me. I want to put it out there. And a lot of my events are the same way. You know, the ticket price or whatever is you choose the price. So that's one way that I am kind of experimenting in gift economy. It doesn't mean that I don't accept money or don't use money, but it's, I guess, kind of like a different spirit that feels a lot better to me.
It probably also means that you're not as rich as you probably could be.
Hey, yeah, I mean, like, I'm not getting rich, of course, but, you know, like, if I hadn't put it out there and made it freely available, who knows, you know? Maybe people wouldn't have embraced it as wholeheartedly. Maybe it wouldn't have spread virally, you know? Maybe, like, a lot of our logic that says that well-being comes through control isn't true, and we're learning that. We're learning that on many levels, like well-being on the collective level. Does it come through control of nature, through, you know, pesticides and herbicides and you know, imposing our will onto the natural world? It's not working very well. Our efforts to control reality are backfiring. Or like, how about schools? You know, does a good school, a safe school, come through fences and metal detectors and locked doors? And you know, every time that control fails, our response is to control even more. Like, I think we're really reaching the end of that paradigm. And so I think it's true on a personal level as well.
I was really struck by something I read, it might have been on your website, where you said that your main interest is exploring the boundaries of what is possible.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Our understanding of what's possible on a political level, or even on like a technological or scientific level, is based on our deep narrative that says, here's what's real, here's what's important, here's what's possible. So I was educated at Yale University, mathematics and philosophy, you know, and graduating, I felt that I had a pretty good handle on not only what was true, but on how to pursue truth, how to pursue knowledge. And I thought that the kind of Western scientific worldview was maybe not complete, but on the way to being complete. Maybe still we needed to fill in a few details, but the scientific method would eventually give us all of that information. And then I went to Taiwan and experienced so many things that flagrantly violated the worldview that I had accepted as undeniable. And so that kind of opened me up to the possibility that reality is a lot bigger than I had been told.
Can you give me an example of that? I mean, what's something that happened in Taiwan that kind of rocked your world?
Oh, geez. I mean, I had experiences with Chinese medicine, you know, with Qigong, you know, and I met a lot of people. I mean, I could tell you maybe a little story. You know, I sprained my ankle really, really badly trying to start my motorcycle. And by the time I got to work, so I took a taxi to work. By the time I got to work, it was swollen to like double its size, you know, red, throbbing from my ankle all the way down to my foot. And the bartender, I was working at a bar, just adding that detail to add some extra credibility to Charles Eisenstein here, working at a bar. And so the bartender's like, oh, man, we got to take you to the doctor. So he takes me to the doctor, and it wasn't any doctor that I'd ever experienced. You know, it was a one-room clinic with a concrete floor, no separate examination room. You know, the patients were kind of waiting in a short line while each one was getting examined and talking about their, you know, itchy hemorrhoids or whatever, you know, in full view of everybody else. And the doctor was smoking a cigarette. So this was like totally contrary.
Right.
But I was in a lot of pain and I was like, okay, you know, whatever. I'm in this, you know, for good or ill. So he gets to me and I'd had an injury like this in college running cross country. It took 6 weeks to heal. I was on crutches and this was every bit as painful. And the doctor sits me down and he starts digging his thumbs into that swollen ankle, pulling on my toes, doing all, it was a torture session for about 10 minutes. I was gripping the chair in agony. you know, what is happening to me? And then he slaps this paste on it, wraps it up, sends me home. The next morning it was better. It was miraculous, basically. Obviously, he knew something that none of the trainers and physicians at Yale knew. And of course, I also had a counter story in my head, which was, well, maybe it wasn't that bad after all. You know, maybe I was just panicking because I'm in a foreign country and so on and so forth. And this has led me to understand that we don't choose our beliefs based on evidence. Ultimately, there's always a different story.
What do you think that doctor did?
I mean, there's I don't know. yeah, I don't know. I don't know what he did. But it was fairly routine for him.
Hmm.
And so I came across many, many other stories that are kind of on the margins of reality as we know it. you know, ghost stories, you know, stories about Taoist shamans and I mean, all kinds of stuff. And you know, I could dismiss any one of those stories quite easily as, oh, you know, it's just a local person trying to impress the foreigner, oh, you know, a poor observer of reality, you know, confabulation, selective memory, yada, yada, yada. But eventually I realized that I was exercising a kind of ideological or cultural imperialism, assuming that my knowledge of the world was the right way to do things. And I had been, and it just seemed like very parallel to economic and political imperialism. And so I began to question it. And but here's one other thing. If we restrict ourselves to what is practical and feasible and realistic, our planet is doomed. Because the things that have to happen on a political level, they're going to take a miracle to change course in time.
You're talking about climate change, for instance.
For example, climate change, ecocide in general. Or even to have, you know, a peaceful, happy society. You know, I mean, there is so much trauma that's built in on every level. So, you know, I've become very interested in the impossible or the miraculous, you know, kind of like stories of reconciliation, of forgiveness, things like that. Things that are happening in South Africa or Rwanda, you know, healing of trauma that you would expect to fuel ongoing hatred and violence for centuries.